Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with University at Albany President Robert J. Jones. Dr. Jones became the 19th president of the University of Albany in January 2013, following 34 years at the University of Minnesota, where he was on the faculty in agronomy and plant genetics and later served in several key leadership positions. Dr. Jones is widely recognized for his work to advance public engagement in higher education and his leading efforts to strengthen the university's partnership in the community and beyond. He is co-convener of the Albany Promise Cradle to Career Partnership and co-chair of the Capital Region Economic Development Council. Nationally, he also serves on the boards of the Coalition of Urban Serving Universities, the Scholars at Risk Network, and the National Science Foundation's Committee on Equal Opportunities in Science and Engineering. Dr. Jones is currently leading a comprehensive transformation effort to expand the university's academic profile, provide a sound financial foundation, and harness UAlbany's research, teaching, and expertise towards the betterment of the Capital Region, New York State, and the world. We'll talk to UAlbany President Robert Jones about all of this and much more. But first, welcome, Dr. Jones.
Thank you. It's such an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Jones, how did you get where you are? I mean, how did it all start? Where were you born?
I was born and raised in a little small rural community in southwestern Georgia called Dawson, Georgia, which is in Terrell or Terrell County, depending on where you're from. It's down in Peanut Country in what is called the Coastal Plain, which is southwestern Georgia, about 50 miles from the Alabama border, about 162 miles southwest of Atlanta, Georgia. So down in Peanut Country.
So how was that growing up a black child, you know, in a previously, anyway, racist area?
Well, as you might imagine, I grew up kind of in the middle of the civil rights movement, and my father was a sharecropper on a peanut and cotton farm. And, you know, it was a very interesting but character-building experience in many ways, because by being a sharecropper, clearly we had to spend a lot of our time working to harvest, to plant and to harvest and to care for crops during each growing season. But as kids, we always found a way to enjoy ourselves by exploring the swamps down behind the sharecropper shack that we lived in. Had a chance to learn how to swim in a gator-infested pond without being there to lunch or dinner.
Really?
And so it was kind of an adventurous time for three black kids growing up who had to create their own way of having fun, but had parents that were absolutely committed to education, notwithstanding the fact my parents only had probably about a seventh and eighth grade education between them. They really valued education, and unlike a lot of the kids in the community whose parents kept them out of school consistently to harvest crops, my father was pretty adamant, and I gained a lot of respect, which I come to realize as an adult, when he had the courage to tell the sharecropper that his kids would not miss a day out of school to harvest crops. Now, that didn't mean that when that school bus rolled through that plantation at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we got off the school bus and we had to work until dark to help with the harvesting of the crop at the end of the day. But the fact of the matter is, he was pretty adamant that we would not miss time out of school to do farm work. But we worked on weekends and after school every day except Sunday, basically to help my father, you know, and my mother bring about the livelihood that allow us to in many ways have a better quality of life than a lot of other folks similarly situated.
Did your folks live long enough to see your success?
Yes, in many ways. Unfortunately, my mother passed in 1988, just as I became a full professor at the University of Minnesota.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and my father passed about 6 years ago. So he had a chance to see me become, a senior leader at the University of Minnesota. And so I know they were very, very proud of what, with their assistance and assistance of many other folks, I was able to achieve both academically and career-wise in terms of the administrative positions that I pursued.
How about your siblings? How'd they do?
My brother had some four-year college education, but he was a graduate of technical school. His original training was in kind of electronics. But unfortunately, he never was able to get a job in electronics back in the late 60s and early 70s. So ultimately, he ended up got a job when a new grocery store came to my hometown called the Piggly Wiggly. He worked his way up from being a meat cutter in the Piggly Wiggly to actually managing that meat department of the Piggly Wiggly store at the time of his untimely death. He died in a boating accident in about 1993. Mm-hmm. But I have a sister who's I'm the middle child. My sister worked her way through college while being the executive secretary at the high school. And she ultimately retired from teaching when she was about 51 years old, basically to take care of my father, who had become incapacitated. And so she retired to take care of him. But my sister still lives down in Georgia, and she and my brother-in-law, and they are very actively involved as retirees. And my brother-in-law is a minister. He actually just started a church. We're very, very proud of them. He had been waiting to be called by an established church, and that never happened. So they turned the carriage house or their garage into a church. And ultimately, about 6 months ago, they found a beautifully decorated church building that was unoccupied at the time. And so they've started a church that keeps them busy now. So
Dr. Jones, let me ask you this. You're an agronomist, right?
Yes, agronomy is, most people get confused about what that really means. So I sometimes just say I'm a plant biologist, plant physiologist is what I'm trained in. But I was educated through agronomy departments and actually spent 34 years as a professor in the agronomy and plant genetics department at the University of Minnesota. And I also was a faculty member in the graduate program in the plant biology program. But I'm a plant physiologist by training.
I was listening to the BBC. I leave the house very early in the morning, around 2:30. I was listening to the BBC, and they had a whole half an hour on the question of whether or not plants have intelligence. Whether plants have intelligence. What do you think?
You probably should have been listening to something else. I'm not sure what they mean by intelligence.
Well, they can make decisions. Go this way or go that way, you know.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't call it making decisions. Just say that you and I are influenced by the environment. A lot of what happens with plants is from an environmental stimuli.
Yeah.
For example, plants move oftentimes either in response to the direction and the angle of the sun, or it's because of an internal hormonal response that's stimulating growth on one side of the plant where it grows faster on one side than the other. And so it'll cause a plant to bend in a certain direction. And this is all what we call, actually, this was the area of my expertise, and a lot of my research had to do with plant hormones. So just like humans have hormones, plants have hormones that actually dictate a lot of what they do that's really not necessarily cognitive. Mm. It may be cognition in a different perspective.
Yeah.
They don't have a brain, but they do have the ability to respond to different kind of environmental and internal signals that causes them to grow a certain way, that regulates when they flower, when the fruit is born, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. There is the question of the Venus flytrap.
That's an interesting plant. Yes, it is.
Because it can capture, you know.
Yeah, and again, that's all by signals, stimuli that causes a reaction in terms of when an insect comes in for the trap to actually close and for the insects to basically be, it's just another way of them getting nutrients.
It's amazing.
The same way that most of plants take up nutrients from the soil, this is just an alternative mechanism to assimilate nutrition, so.
I want to go back, Dr. Jones, to your childhood and ask you about the role of the church in your upbringing.
Mm-hmm. Well, the church was very fundamentally important to my upbringing because in many ways, I tell this joke, but it's kind of an inside family joke. I actually came from a mixed marriage. My father was an AME and my mother was a Baptist. Okay, and I used to enjoy the kind of banter back and forth between my mom and my dad sometime about, you know, which church doctrine was most appropriate, the African Methodist Episcopal Church versus the traditional Black Baptist Church. And the fact of the matter is that they used to have these little discussions, but my mom, even though she was a member of a Baptist church a good 15 miles north of the plantation we grew up on, my dad was a steward in the AME church a good 15 miles south, actually in another county, was where his home church that had been in my, you know, Joneses had been in that church for more than 100 years or more.
Mm-hmm.
But my father would always go to church with my mom and sit among the deacons, even though he was a steward. And my mom would always sit among the elders in the AME church. Each of these church, one met on first Sunday, the other met on second Sunday. So we knew where we were going to be the first and second Sunday of every month. And then the third and fourth Sunday, we had cousins and other relatives who were a member of other black churches in that rural community. And so we would attend as guests at one of those other churches. So every Sunday, I was in church somewhere, either in my mom's church or my dad's church or neighbors or friends' churches. And so grew up very much in the church. And as you know, the ME Church has practices and procedures that's more comparable to the Catholic Church. So that was interesting, observing the difference when I attended my dad's church versus the lack of a lot of pomp and circumstance and ceremony at the Black Baptist Church. But grew up singing in the choir.
I was just about to ask you about the singing. Very important, right?
That's where I got involved in singing in the choir, and church was something that we didn't have an option about. We had to be there every Sunday. And because my mother was an amazing cook, regardless of whether it was the pastor of my dad's church or her church, we always seemed to have a minister in our home for dinner almost every Sunday. And so I grew up with that kind of experience as well, where we had to wait to eat dinner until the pastor and his family finished eating, and then we could always eat less.
Family hold back.
That's exactly right.
So. Well, it couldn't have been easy for your folks. I mean, sharecroppers don't make a lot of money, and then they had to feed the preachers.
Had to feed the preachers, absolutely. It wasn't an option. That was the easy part, though, because sharecropping wasn't easy. But my father was very much an entrepreneur. He stopped sharecropping eventually because I remember vividly it was the Christmas where we only made like a bale of cotton off for about 14 acres because of that infamous insect called the boll weevil, who wreaked havoc throughout the South that year. It was very hard for most farmers to make a decent living.
And who we all sang about.
You sang about a lot of controversial songs about the old boll weevil. But, you know, notwithstanding that, my father decided shortly day after, you know, an agreement with the plantation owner to switch over to being a day laborer, which really wasn't, it was slightly better. You know, at least you knew you were going to get paid X number of dollars rather than waiting till the end of the year to kind of see how much you owed to company store versus how much you would actually have at settlement time, it was called. That's when the plantation owners would settle with the sharecroppers in terms of the amount of money that they would have actually to sustain them for another year.
So there really was a company store.
Yeah, I mean, that was a little store in this little plantation that actually the building is still there today.
I could
put you in the car and drive you down there and show it to you today. It hasn't been occupied, oh my God, long, long time. But it's the store that until the larger grocery stores in my hometown came into being. The Colonial store was an old grocery store chain that my dad actually worked on Saturday nights. He was responsible for cleaning the cutting room. And I think somehow or another, that's how my brother got involved in the meat cutting business. So as I didn't mention, but I worked my way through college as a meat cutter at Piggly Wiggly as well, my junior and senior year. So I guess that maybe evolved from us going in and helping my dad clean up the cutting room in the Colonial store when we were kids. But back to your point, it was interesting growing up as a sharecropper and watching my dad go from initially renting land from the father of this family. And then when the son took over the farm, he kind of sharecropped for a while. And then that went through his cycle, and ultimately he ended up working as a day laborer. So he was essentially paid by the day to work on the farm, and so was the rest of us if we pick cotton or whatever, we were paid based on the amount of cotton you picked each and every day. And so that was the kind of environment I grew up in. But my father was very entrepreneurial. And so I remember vividly, probably as I was going into high school, he convinced the landowner to allow him to put up electrical fences around pretty much all of the peanut and corn fields around the sharecropper shack that we lived in, and use it as a way to go from having no more than about 10 to 15 heads of hog to actually, at its peak, we were raising over 300 heads of hogs every year.
Did they become friends? Did you know them by name or
no,
not?
No, we didn't get that close and personal with our food
especially
stores.
In the butcher business.
I was talking to a young lady at her local restaurants about why she didn't eat pork, and it was interesting because she grew up in the southern part of the state here, and I guess they became very personal with their hogs.
Friends, yeah.
No, we didn't get that personal with the hogs that we were raising. It was a food source, and it was the difference between just getting by for my father to really, for the first time, you know, probably having less worries about money, because at that time, you know, he was making more money from the auxiliary enterprise of raising hogs than he was from working as a day laborer, driving tractor and cultivating and harvesting crops. That was his job. But he was making more money from the hog enterprise than he was from the day labor situation.
How about the civil rights movement? You referred to it before. How aware were you that there were changes coming?
You know, very much aware that there were changes because I had several cousins. My dad's sister kids were probably 5 to 6 years older than we were at the time. And two of those brothers were very actively involved in the civil rights movement, so much so that twice they were expelled from the local high school because of being involved with marches with Dr. Martin Luther King. If you read history of the civil rights movement, you'll know that Dr. King spent a lot of time in the other place called Albany, Georgia, which is 19 miles south of where I grew up. It's the adjoining county. And my cousin lived in another adjoining county. That's a place where Terrell County, Albany, Georgia's in Daugherty County, and Leesburg, Georgia, named after General Lee, is in Lee County. Those counties kind of converge and come together. Albany is just across the county line from Terrell County and Lee County. And so my two cousins were very actively involved in integrating the soda fountain at the local Woolworth store in Albany that had a soda fountain back in those days. All the Woolworths and the Five and Dimes had soda fountains. They were involved in integrating with that, marching and protesting, being involved in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and marching with Dr. King and protesting. So I was very much aware through them, but also we were a little young to get deeply involved in that. You know, I was born in 1951. And so we didn't get actively involved myself, but through my cousins and knowing the work that they were doing, we were very much aware that there was a change afoot and that it was making a significant difference. Because just to kind of give you a sense of a timeline, the high school that I graduated from George Washington Carver High School in 1969, which was the last segregated high school students graduated from that high school. Integration occurred the next year. And so we were the last class to graduate from the segregated school, I should say 100% segregated, because in many ways, for the decades after, it remains, mostly African-American. The teaching force is integrated, but in that small community, people decided that they wanted to have a different alternative. So that's when the first private schools were developed, the year after forced integration was put into place. So that's kind of the experience in the background I came out of.
Did you ever personally feel racial prejudice directed at you or even?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We lived with it as a course. It was just as common as me walking on the street, observing anything that's contemporary today. It was part of that society where you couldn't grow up in the South during that particular time period and not encounter very blatant racism. It's not subtle in ways that it is today. It was very blatant, in your face, you know, where you had to contend with being called names or just treated very, very differently, just as the way things were. There were certain places we knew we couldn't go in the front door. You had to go around to the side door at the local Dairy Queen or other establishments if you wanted to be served. And, you know, had a few of my own run-ins with blatant racism where my livelihood, my life was in jeopardy at least once, because of the mindset around racism. And so it was a very difficult environment to live in.
You're not getting away with that without telling me that story.
No, I'm not going to okay. go into it.
You can't do it. But you really felt your life was in danger.
Let's just say there's an experience that you never will forget, and that's the sound of someone cocking a pump shotgun.
Wow.
And aiming it at you.
Wow.
And yeah. I'll just leave it at that.
That's fine. Let me ask about whether your father ever had, quote, the conversation with you about what you should or shouldn't do in order to survive in that situation?
Oh, very much so. We knew that, you know, being a sharecropper in an environment, the only conversation he had, one that I remember most vividly, was the proper way to address the plantation owners and to how to show respect to them, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't listen for the most part.
We are having a great conversation with University at Albany President Robert J. Jones. Well, Mr. President, when you went to graduate school, how'd you pay for it?
Well, graduate school, you asked me, but let me tell you about undergraduate first,
sure.
If you don't mind.
Not
well,
at all.
Undergraduate, I paid for it because, again, my parents were sharecroppers, so I knew quite clearly there was no way. They wanted me to get an education, but they couldn't pay for it. And so my junior and senior year, myself and about four or five of my best friends decided that if we wanted to go to college, their father was sharecroppers as well, at least the twins' father were sharecroppers, that we'd had to somehow or another come up with some money. And so we started working full-time at a local manufacturing plant. They made rubber parts on the contracts from the big three automakers, and like brake pedal covers, acceleration pads, anything that's on a car at that time was made out of rubber. There was a company that had a subdivision out of Sandusky, Ohio, I think it was, who built a plant down in my hometown. So during my junior and my senior year, the six of us, worked full-time jobs, 11 o'clock at night to 7 o'clock in the morning, take a shower, get ready sitting in class at 8.
Wow.
And there was more than one occasion where we actually pulled a double shift, which meant we went in at 3 o'clock as soon as class was over and worked until 7 o'clock the next morning. And that was the mechanism by which I saved enough money to pay for my first year as an undergraduate at Fort Valley State College. And we worked that job almost for 2 years, but we got fired after we graduated because we made the mistake of telling the foreman he wanted to put us on a day shift because he was just assumed that we were going to, after we finished high school, we were going to work there for the rest of our lives. And we told him, no, we want to stay where we are because we only going to work until probably August or September because we were going to go to college. We were fired before the day it was over.
Really?
All
did he say anything to you about
no,
what?
No, just told us we were gone. We were done. So the conversation went from, I want to move you to the day shift to, you don't work here anymore. And so one of my friends, and I teased him about this at an event back in my hometown a few months ago, I was fine with sitting out the rest of the summer. But no, he had to go down to the local peanut cleaning plant and got a job for the five of us to run a peanut cleaning plant. And that's part of the whole peanut harvest operation where the farmers would bring the peanuts in on the back of a truck. And then my job was when the semi driver would drive the truck up, they would get out and go have lunch. My job was to drive the semi up to this big hydraulic platform that you drove the truck on, and it would tilt the back end down. And the peanuts would roll out of the back and go down this conveyor belt to this cleaning station where it separated the peanuts from the trash that was included in the harvest process. And so we did that for about 2 months until it was time to go off to Fort Valley. And so it was a dirty job, but in some ways it was more interesting than working in the rubber manufacturing plant. So we did that. That's how I paid for that's actually how I paid for my first year as an undergraduate. And then the second year, I was fortunate enough to get different jobs working as a laboratory technician because I was an agriculture major. And so I had access to the professors who needed lab techs, someone to clean glassware, someone to help run small experiments. So I did that. I also drove tractor on the college farm, because we had must have been 300 or 400, 600 acre farm. And so I drove tractor on the farm, worked in the laboratory. And then it was my junior year where the guy who was my major advisor at Fort Valley State University, and the guy's probably responsible for more black kids going on to get master's or PhDs in agriculture than anyone in the country that I know of. He always insisted that we had to at least get a master's degree, and the ones he thought had the ability to get PhDs, he worked hard to find them places to get PhDs. And so I did that, but he knew I needed some additional income because of some life events that had occurred. So he got me a job as a trainee, as a meat cutter at the local Piggly Wiggly. And so I worked that job. And again, by the time it was time for me to go to graduate school, I had a little bit of income and was fortunate enough to get an assistantship to attend the University of Georgia that must pay about $3,000 a year. And so that's how.
A lot of money then.
It was a lot in some ways, but insufficient in others, because I subsidized that assistantship with two jobs. I had a job delivering two newspaper routes that I would run, one in the morning and one in the afternoon. And after I did the morning newspaper route, I had a job driving a van, 18 or 22 passenger, I don't remember, van, where I had a job of going across a three-county area picking up people to take them to a sheltered workshop, a people that were disabled.
Yeah.
And they had this sheltered workshop where they would come in and work, you know, until about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then I would go back and pick them up in the afternoon and deliver them back to their home and then go back to my lab and study and do my experiments until late in the evening. So that's how I financed my at the master's level. But then fortunately, when I went to University of Missouri, I had an assistantship that paid substantially more. And I did well enough my first year that I was a recipient of the George Washington Carver Fellowship that paid $7,000 a year tax-free.
Yeah.
Now, that, Alan, was the most amount of money I ever had. I felt like I was living the lifestyle of the rich and famous then.
I know. I got $6,000 during my PhD time.
Right,
And I don't think I've ever had more money than that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's all relative, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all relative.
It was terrific. Just to remind everybody, and we are delighted to be doing this, we're in conversation today with University at Albany President Robert J. Jones. All right. So you go to the University of Minnesota?
No, I actually graduated from Fort Valley State College in Georgia as an undergraduate, University of Georgia as a master's degree student, and University of Missouri as a PhD. I started receiving my PhD when I was 26.
What'd you write on?
You mean in terms of my thesis?
Yeah.
In Missouri?
Yeah.
Well, at Georgia, I worked on peanuts.
No, but I know. But my PhD was mental health policy making in three American states. That was the name of it.
Yeah.
It was about,
At Georgia, what I wrote on, to use your terminology, was the calcium nutrition in the peanut pegging zone.
No.
The effect of rainfall and irrigation on peanut production in southwestern Georgia.
What was that?
Well, as I said, you know, Georgia's peanut country.
Right, right.
Dawson, Georgia's, my hometown was the peanut capital of the world during that time period.
You had a president from there,
I've heard of that guy. Yeah, that was a president from there who had a famous brother that I used to buy gas from when I was on my way to college.
That's right.
Because my roommate was from Plains, Georgia.
Uh-huh.
I was the only kid that had a car, so I used to drive by to pick him up in Plains, and we'd buy gas at Billy's Guff service station. And actually, it's kind of ironic. I only recently had a chance to I probably saw former President Carter for the first time about 5 or 6 years ago. But I used to see Billy all the time at it during the time that I was undergraduate. So the thesis was about the fact that, and I'll try to be succinct with this, the key issue is that peanut production, the South became the place as a major region for producing peanuts because of the sandy soils in this particular part of the state. But the only way you can grow peanuts is you have to put on a lot of lime. I mean, tons and tons of lime on top of the soil in order to have enough calcium for the plant to make the nut. It goes back to what you asked me earlier about plants having cognitive ability or thinking. Well, the fact of the matter is that if you don't provide an artificial environment that's very, very high in calcium in the top 2 inches of soil in a peanut production situation, you don't get peanuts because the plant can't take the calcium up by the roots. It has to be taken up by the pod itself as it develops in the top 2 inches of soil. So subsequently, throughout the South, farmers buy tons and tons of gypsum and dump it on the soil in these sandy soils, and it has to be able to withstand the whole season of rainfall. You can't leach all of it out. You have to have enough of it there during the time that the fruit is actually developing below ground. A lot of people think peanuts grow on the roots. No, they don't. They come down from the vines through a thing called a gynophore peg that once it's pollinated, it grows toward the soil. And then this is another one of those hormonal responses. The sand is coarse, and so the tip of this gynophore is really sensitive to abrasion. So as the peg grows down into the sandy soil, the abrasion causes a hormonal response that causes the nut to swell, and the pollen tube then grows into that swelling pod, and that's where the seed is born. So it's an interesting physiological. And so I wrote about that because one of the problems was if you could formulate gypsum that was slow release, that wouldn't be susceptible to leaching, you could minimize the amount of gypsum that you would have to put on the farmer's field, reduce cost, and increase their production.
Wow.
So that's what that was all about.
Fascinating.
And when I went to Missouri, I was asked to join a research project with probably one of the world's best-known physiologists. In fact, he spoke at my inauguration a couple of years ago.
Oh, that's great.
Dr. C.J. Nelson, he was the world's expert on forage grasses. And so my PhD research was on photosynthesis and respiration in tall fescue, which is a forage crop that's utilized very heavily in Missouri because people don't realize Missouri has more cows per capita than Texas but most of it is they're grazed and kind of feedlot situation, small paddocks, and the cattle will graze. They're not usually fed a lot of corn. And so that's what I worked on there. And then when I was recruited to go to work at University of Minnesota, they specifically wanted someone to come as a physiologist to join. This was kind of at the beginning of what we now call multidisciplinary research. They wanted a physiologist to join a team of professors that included a plant breeder, a plant production person, and they wanted a physiologist to join this multidisciplinary team to start working on increasing the production of maize or corn. And so I was basically working on corn for 34 and a half years in Minnesota.
Really?
So peanuts, grass, and corn is what I've spent my life researching for more than 40 years.
I love it, and that's a great story. So now let's just take you up to being at the University at Albany. And again, I want to remind everybody we're in conversation today with University at Albany President Robert J. Jones. So how did you get recruited to come to Albany? Oh, there was one other question I had to ask you,
Okay. Which
you know I'm going to ask you, which is that you're a recipient of a Grammy Award for your singing in a group, in a gospel group. So tell me about that.
Well, that, again, grew out of the fact that at 26 years old, I found myself in St. Paul, Minneapolis, Minnesota area, newly minted PhD, the only African-American in my department. I think I was the second person maybe in an entire college, and felt a sense of isolation. And so being reared in the church, of course, I joined the church immediately. That was the first thing I did. Started to sing with the church choir, and that led to me singing with the choral ensemble at Easter. They would have this thing called Gospel Choirs United, where all the black churches would get together and create this massive couple, 300 people choir, and we would do this big concert, as a fundraiser and to celebrate the Easter. I think it was always done around Easter. And so I was sitting next to this guy doing that rehearsal who was from another church, and he said, "You have a pretty good voice. Have you ever considered singing with the Sounds of Blackness?" And I said, "The Sounds of what?" And he said, "The Sounds of Blackness." I said, "No, I never heard of them." And he says, "A local choral ensemble started out as McAllister College Black Choir. McAllister is a very fine, well-known private university in St. Paul, Minnesota. But this group started there, as a black choir. And after they graduated, they involved into this choral ensemble, and there was as many as 80 people as a part of this group at one time. When I joined it, it was about 20 individuals, and I auditioned for it and spent about 30 years performing with them. And,
30 years? Wow.
Yeah, from 1980 until 2010.
Wow.
I just stopped singing with them in 2010. And to make a long story short, during the course of that 30-year period, like the last decade or so, we were actually discovered by Janet Jackson, believe it or not.
Wow.
Who was working with a couple of local producers, guys named Jimmy Jam Harris and Terry Lewis, who used to be part of Prince's band at the time. And Prince fired them when they didn't show up for a gig because they got trapped in Atlanta because of a snowstorm. And so they started working on their own. And they were introduced, by a guy named Clarence Avon was his name, who I think was the president of a big record company in L.A. at the time. Introduced them to Janet Jackson, and subsequently, they're the guys behind the scene that made Janet Jackson the big name star that she is today because they wrote and produced all of her albums for more than a decade.
Right.
They brought her to one of our concerts that we used to do on an annual basis. And so she was sitting there listening after she had just finished, I think it was her Rhythm Nation CD. And she said, "What are we going to do tonight?" And he said, "Well, there's this local group that has a show. We always go see them occasionally. So we're going to take you to see the Sounds of Blackness." And So she's sitting there, and apparently the way that Jimmy Jam Harris tells the story, during the whole concert, she kept elbowing him and said, "These guys are good." And she elbows him again and said, "Do they have a recording contract?" And he says, "I don't think so. I don't know." Well, Long story short, as soon as the concert was over, they brought her backstage, introduced her to all 20-some-odd of us, and pulled our director to the side and said, well, she seemed to think you guys are good enough to have a recording contract, and so we want to talk to you about that. And the rest is history. We signed a recording contract with them. They created the record label Perspective Records, which was a partnership between Flight Time, which was the name of their company, located there in a suburb of Edina, Minnesota, is where their studios were located. And they did a partnership with A&M Records to create Perspective A&M Records. And that was the record label that we recorded under for about 6 years, I think, and ended up getting 2 Grammy Awards and 2 gold records and 1 platinum record.
Wow.
So that's how I got
involved. What's the name of the group? So if anybody wants to go find it.
The Sounds of Blackness. You can Google, you can go on YouTube and find almost every song that we recorded over almost a 30-year period.
So let's get right to the University at Albany. I love your story, by the way. I just think it's fabulous. But you get recruited to come here. What was that like, that recruitment process?
Well, the recruitment process was actually itself relatively brief because I didn't, you know, of course, I was very much aware of the University at Albany because I was very much aware of the SUNY system, so I had good knowledge of the university. But I was basically nominated by someone to see if I would interest in taking a look at the position and didn't think much about it and had a chance to talk to a few people from the SUNY system about the opportunity before I put my name in the hat. Had a brief conversation with the chancellor because, ironically, I was already working with her since about 2008.
That's Chancellor Zimfer?
Chancellor Zimfer. Yeah. I first met her through my former boss, the president of the University of Minnesota, because her husband, Ken Howell, was a professor at University of Minnesota for a while. And he and my former boss, who was the president at the time, used to play basketball together when they were faculty colleagues. And he made me responsible as the senior vice president for University of Minnesota's urban agenda. Uh-huh. In other words, how do you take a massive research university and make it more strategic and intentional about its role as an urban university?
Which is something you're very much committed to at the University of Albany.
Absolutely. And so this is what led to me getting more interested in this job. And that's how I met Chancellor Zimfer, because she was instrumental in starting something called the Coalition of Urban Serving Universities. I essentially represented my boss on that board. I was representing the president of the university. In fact, I was the only non-president on that board for, God, almost 7-8 years until I got this job.
So as the old saying goes, she knew your work when it came
to
time.
She knew my work. She was familiar with me. And I want to be clear, she didn't really encourage or discourage me from looking at the job. She just made me aware when I approached her about, I said, I heard somebody is nominating me for this job. Tell me a little bit about the university. And we had a good conversation. I threw my name in a hat. And
you got
and
it.
Of course, you know, she's on the back end of this process. The committee recommended me as the finalist for the position. And that's when I interviewed with her and interviewed with the Board of Trustees, Chairman McCall, and then the full board. And the rest is history.
We know all those guys pretty well. We love Carl McCall. He's done a lot with us here at the radio. And Nancy Zimfer, of course, has been here many, many times. She's a great, great individual.
Absolutely.
Okay, so now you get the job and you come up with an agenda. Unfortunately, I fell in so much in love with your early life that I haven't left enough time to really do this. So I'm going to give this to you. Tell me what your agenda is and what you want to achieve.
Well, my agenda is pretty straightforward. And that is to move this great university to the next level of excellence. And we have a couple of core strategies to get there. Ultimately, our goal is to move the University of Albany to being a leading public research university in the country and in the world. And the way that we envision getting there is I'm pretty much look at things from a very analytical perspective. So I've spent my first 100 days traveling around the region, better understanding the assets in the region, better understanding the university, meeting with all the deans, meeting with department chairs. And last year I went around and met with all the faculty and all departments, really understanding where the university is today, where it's been, and where getting a sense of where it needs to go. So it's very clear to me that in order for us to move to the next level of excellence and to garner the reputation as a leading public research university, we have to initiate the largest academic expansion of this university in the last 50 years. because the analysis is pretty clear that that's what has been holding this university back. I took this job primarily because I was absolutely amazed with a university with 17,300 or so students that had matched, and with the collection of academic programs, a number of which 19 or 20 are in the top 50 in the country, and more than that in the top 100, had amassed a sponsored research bringing in external dollars, clearly in excess of $200 million. You just don't find this type of institution that doesn't have an engineering school, doesn't have a law school, doesn't have a school of pharmacy and a lot of the basic sciences that more comprehensive universities have the ability to bring in that level of outside research and garner the reputation as a research university of high intensity. And I was absolutely fascinated with that, and that urbanly located. And because of my involvement with Chancellor Zimpher and really helped to reframe my thinking about the role of a research university in solving complex problems in urban communities, all of this really has helped shape my agenda for the university, which is to become a leading public research university, one that is deeply engaged with solving complex problems in urban communities, such as increasing educational attainment among underrepresented groups, working with other partners across the region to resolve the complex issue of poverty. And what do you start with that? You start to educate people better and make sure that underserved populations are educated. But more in an academic context, we are expanding the scope of the university to add those programs, those high needs programs that students want and the state really demands if it's going to grow economically.
For example,
engineering. You really can't become a world-class comprehensive university without having a school of engineering. And so that was one of the first questions I called to the table, is that we needed to think about having a school of engineering and applied sciences. And we have made significant progress. We've developed a curriculum for our first engineering program, which is computer engineering, that's worked its way through our own faculty vetting process, the SUNY system vetting process, and is now in the hands of State Ed Department awaiting approval. That's going to be a game changer for this university and for this region. And one of the reasons I say that is because, yes, we have some very fine engineering schools in the Capital Region. But I remind you, University of Albany is the only public comprehensive university in the entire region. For there not to be a public option for engineering, notwithstanding the fact we have very fine institutions, I've talked to the leaders of Union and RPI, and they will tell you they cannot produce enough graduates to meet the local demand for engineers, let alone the state demand. And so the notion of a public option for engineering, given the changing demographics, given the affordability issue, having a local option for engineering provides an opportunity for students from all walks of life to think about coming to a public institution and getting an engineering degree. It's really very, very appealing, and really makes a lot of sense given where we are at this juncture.
Now, President Jones, that's a good one. We have 10 minutes left. I wanted to make sure we get as much of your agenda in as we possibly can.
Sure. So that's one of the primary ones that we know is a fundamental game changer. The second one that I'll talk about is, you know, the governor has put a lot of confidence in the University of Albany in the last few years. He asked us to stand up this thing called the MESANet, which is 125 interconnected weather stations, to allow the state of New York to do a better job of being able to detect inclement weather, these really unusual weather events that seem to be occurring at a very regular basis. And New York now only has 25 weather stations. And so the notion of this MESANet is New York is one of the areas that is more than likely to has a very high propensity of having an unusual weather event. And so you would think the state would need to have more of a sophisticated infrastructure. So we're building the most sophisticated infrastructure, we think, in the country, probably not even second to what Oklahoma has. In fact, the folks from Oklahoma, University of Oklahoma, are helping us design and build out this MESANet system. And so we're doing that. That's going to provide an opportunity to expand our academic programs, particularly to help expand the work in our atmospheric science department. We have over 60 scholars and scientists in our atmospheric science department, one of the largest atmospheric science departments in the country. We also have the Regional National Weather Service as a part of that entity That's critically important as we think about carrying out the governor's desire that we would be at the cutting edge of being able to develop the sophisticated integrated models that's going to help us do a better job of predicting these unusual storms and deploying resources in a much more strategic way.
Well, we sure hope that you're going to do that well, because WAMC has had a tremendous relationship with your atmospheric sciences group in the past, and we look forward to having more in the future.
And you're going to see more. This is an amazing group that's garnering international reputation as well. We just received almost a $5 million grant to do some work in an international context combined with the local work with the National Taiwanese University. And so this is a very big deal for us, and we are getting a lot of support from places like the National Science Foundation to do some work. And I mention that because it also ties into the next big thing the governor has charged us to do, and that is to create the first integrated College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland, and Cybersecurity in the country. Mm-hmm. And I want to be clear, this is the first of its kind where those three platforms are integrated in one academic collegiate unit. You know, some university will have the cybersecurity or they have the emergency preparedness, but they won't have a college that integrates across all three. And so this is a very awesome responsibility the governor has given us. It's a very daunting but exciting opportunity for us. And we're excited about it because it gives us an opportunity to do something different, to create a college that won't be created along traditional lines. The way I look at it is we're going to be using what I call either a hub and spokes or a consolidation model. Yes, we will have a physical location on or about the UAlbany campus, but it's going to be as much virtual as it is physical, because we're bringing in the best and the brightest expertise across these three platforms wherever we can find it, whether it's in from another state agency or from private universities or CUNY colleges or SUNY colleges. We are not going to try to create the academic content, you know, kind of in a vacuum. This is going to be the state of New York's College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland, and Cybersecurity.
You know, President
Jones, it's going to be integrated across all these different institutes.
You know, President Jones, with your references to the governor, it sounds like he's paying a lot of attention to the University of Albany. Is that right?
I am very proud.
I can see him sitting there thinking about
I am very proud of the fact that during my tenure here, I think we've gotten the attention of the governor's office that this is a fine university and that we have the intellectual capacity to deliver on a lot of innovation if given the opportunity to do so. And he has clearly entrusted us with a lot of big ideas that are too big to fail, and we have to do right and do them extremely well. So we're very, very confident and very proud of the fact that he's placed this confidence in us to really drive some of the innovation that we think is critically important to advance to.
Well, as you may or may not know, I spent many years at the University of Albany as a professor in the Department of Communications. And there were forever being these sort of, well, I don't know how to put it, but tough discussions between the pragmatists, the ones who wanted internships, the ones who wanted to be out there, and the people who wanted to be just rarefied academics.
Mm-hmm.
Have you sort of analyzed that tension?
More than analyze it, we're doing something about it, because it has to move beyond being a tension to being the new strategy by which we prepare the workforce that's necessary to drive economic vitality of the state and the region. You still have to have those folks who are the academics who are doing the basic research that's developing the intellectual property that goes into textbooks, that drives the research agenda for the next level of innovation and intellectual property that's going to create jobs and bring about innovation. But at the same time, higher education has had to come to full grips with the notion that we constantly get bombarded with complaints from the private sector in particular about the fact that our students aren't really prepared for the workforce. And so we're taking these two issues as not things that are opposing to each other. How can you keep the tradition of pure academics, how you keep that pure within the academy, at the same time realize that we can educate our students with a good basic liberal arts education and discipline-specific education, but at the same time, they have to be ready to demonstrate they know how to do things once they get on the job. And so my new provost, Jim Steller, has done an excellent job. He's one of the leading experts around the country in applied learning, experiential learning. And you're going to be hearing more and more about that as a core strategy as we think about how do we create the new University at Albany, one that is providing a world-class liberal arts education, world-class professional education, but also one where our students have practical experience and knowledge that the workforce needs, that they can hit the ground running once they graduate from our institution. And just give you a good example of how we're thinking about this, and the chancellor has articulated this as a platform for all SUNY campuses. We have our own spin on the issue. We're one of five campuses in the state of New York that was recently awarded almost $1 million grant from Blackstone Charitable Trust to launch this entrepreneurial platform at the University at Albany called Blackstone Launchpad, which is a platform by which Blackstone is very clear that all students should graduate, regardless of major. It's not just for business major. Whether you're in English or philosophy, you should have an opportunity to be exposed to entrepreneurial thinking as a part of your undergraduate educational experience at UAlbany.
Are you worried about the fact that some professors have been saying, we're getting too much pragmatism here. We want, you know, more academic rigor, and we don't want that sort of pragmatism?
Well, I'm sure there will be some, but I think through the work of Provost Steller and others and through our work with our Student Affairs Office, I think we're finding a way that people will understand that we will continue to drive for academic excellence in a traditional context. But we also have to think about excellence in terms of experiential learning, because whether we like it or not, the landscape has changed. And you can bury your head in the sand and just say, we're not going to do that. And I can tell you, you will be on the wrong bus, arriving at the station at the wrong time. You will be completely out of the game as a leading public research university.
So true. I got hired at Albany because of my having set up one of the original internships in the state legislature and my Legislative Gazette project. And I think that's right. You can put a kid in a legislator's office and they're going to know more about the legislative process than somebody who reads it out of a book.
I can tell you our summer semester in Washington program is a prime example of this.
Sure.
I meet with these young people every near the end of their experience, and I am just blown away at how it transformed their understanding of specific civic issues, policy issues at both the local and national level. These students are placed in the White House, the Department of Justice, and for working for leading congressmen and senators from around the country. It's just an absolutely amazing, game-changing experiential learning opportunity that makes them very highly sought after when they graduate from our university. That is what's going to set us apart, and we're trying to replicate that model in other ways. That's why the Blackstone Launchpad is critically important. That's why providing more experiential and research learning opportunities for our students is critically important. So this is part of the new American universities that people are going to have to get used to, because it's a paradigm shift, and I think it's a critically important one that's going to make us very, very effective at educating the masses, but also making sure folks have practical skills that can be applied day one when they walk on the job.
We've been in conversation today with University at Albany President Robert J. Jones. Dr. Jones, I can't tell you how much I loved this interview. I loved your story, and I loved what you're trying to do at SUNY at Albany, and thank you for all you're doing.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity to be here.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.